this part we are in this chapter, we are discussing the nature of the domestic bee. And he's talking about how the three transformations that he has introduced earlier exist in the Gnostic beauty. How the individual, the overmind and consciousness, or the overman and the superman, the supernatural beauty, how they are included and form, you can say, three dimensions of the Gnostic being. So one thing is that we discussed a little bit last time. Think about descriptions of the mind. Descriptions of the mind, such as what we are involved in as we discuss these things, tend to create structures. It's as if we grasp the nature of the Gnostic being in terms of these terms, like individual, cosmic, superman, and superman, etc. And they tend to give a certain mission to Gnostic being. As a matter of fact, there is a paradoxical element to that. And the paradoxical element comes from the fact that there is diverse possible over here. With this kind of tripartite understanding of Gnostic being, nevertheless, high quality of its manifestation. So, that is something that Aurobindo has brought up here. That in the very understanding of these three levels, we see the reality at work. The index at the individual level is the basis of reality, because we find that its soul, to look at each individual being, has something unique about it. Even if we consider a combination of soul power, there is something unique. And this is what gives each individual a certain being, somebody, someone, a who. Now, that kind of sense of separateness, a sense of separate existence, also becomes the stamp of the ego and the difficulty of the fullness of existence. So we'd like to maintain the individual difference, we're also threatened by the fact of its difference from others. And this brings in all the problems of existence. However, this uniqueness of the individual is something necessary if there is to be a other individual. And so, this individual element is something that we realize, and at the same time, we overcome for the sense of separateness to the psychic realization. In the psychic realization, there's the knowledge of the individuality of the soul, but at the same time, recognition of the same in the forms in others. So that kind of experience overcomes the limitations of the ego, or the limitation of the ego with that of separateness. There is distinction, but no separation. However, even there, there's the limitation. The limitation of the soul's existence within the ignorance, that is, cosmic condition in which we find ourselves, is that this is distinct from the cosmos. Each soul, though, I mean, that there's something the same between not human beings and everything in the universe, the level of the soul. Yet, there is also a limited condition of cosmic forces to which we experience the universe. So, form a certain kind of individual priestess experience. So each one experiences the universe in a specific key. Now, in the realization of the cosmic being, sense of separation, distinction disappears. There is the sense of one being that becomes a creature. Experience is the metric of individual possibility. Yes, watching a cosmic creature, we lose individual distinction. We get a sense of the one containing all, but our inner existence becomes lost. However, there is a return to the coexistence of these two, a coexistence of the selective nature of individual soul and the inclusive nature of being in their life. Then, if over-mental transformation occurs and the psychic being, the soul, enters into identity with the over-mental purusha, there's a sense in which one finds that the individual is a center of the universal system. So, individual is center of universal existence. Everybody having some problem with my, in terms of, it's not coming out purely for saying, is this, distorted?
It's really, it's distorted. Yes,
okay. So, we will just debate, terms, I guess.
Yeah, I'm back. I'm back.
So it seems continue for a little bit, see how it sounds, because some people think that they can't hear properly.
Yeah, there's a lot of breaking.
Breaking up.
Yeah, there's a lot of breaking when you're speaking, Devashisla. Everybody else, when Mary Lou spoke, it seemed clear. Is my voice clear? Is it only Devashisda or is it something?
Yeah, I hear you clearly.
Yeah, so I guess it's only your voice that's broken a bit. And unfortunately, that is not, that doesn't help us. So, should we stop it and try to restart and see if that helps?
Again?
Yeah, that might help because, yeah.
So, let me continue. I was talking about the distinction between the individual and the cosmic in the experience. And then this forms a kind of a duality. One may have both experiences, and there is a certain kind of difference in the quality of experience. The experience of the soul is a experience based in individualism, but that of the overmind is an experience based in universality. Now, the two can coexist, and in fact, the individual can be seen as an aspect of the cosmic. That kind of sense can emerge. But still, there is a lack of completeness because at the level of the cosmic, the soul is still limited by a choice of, separation. There seems to be almost like a choice of selection of quality. Now, in supermind, that limitation goes away. In supermind, there is the sense of the one being that is dynamically choosing to limit itself for the sake of the play. In other words, this is a transcendental awareness or consciousness in which the cosmic condition of the play is maintained dynamically. At every moment, there is a choice retain the entire matrix of soul possibilities and the individual selection that forms each soul. So here is the third point, and there's a paragraph before this, two paragraphs before this, where Sri Aurobindo actually talks about all the trinities being realized in a Gnostic realization, a realization of the Gnostic being. This idea of all the trinities refers to the fact that every possibility in the universe, in the cosmic existence, comes in pairs, in dual pairs. That is one of the conditions of the ignorance. The third of the transcendental poise in which these two are overcome, the duality is overcome and transformed, the duality being seen as two aspects of the third. These are the trinities. There can be many different types of trinities. Now, those trinities are being looked at from the viewpoint of this specific trinity of what Sri Aurobindo calls the triple poise of the supermind. That is, a transcendental poise, a cosmic or universal poise, and a psychic or soul or individual poise. So that's where we are, where Sri Aurobindo is discussing how the three coexist and how they are given their fullness of significance and experience in the Gnostic being.
Vince, do you want to read the first paragraph?
Sure, beginning with first. Sorry.
Beginning with the three powers which present themselves. It's on page 973.
Sure. The three powers which present themselves to our life as the three keys to its mystery are the individual, the cosmic entity, and the reality present in both and beyond them. These three mysteries of existence we find in the life of the supramental being, a united fulfillment of their harmony. He will be the perfected and complete individual, fulfilled in the satisfaction of his growth and self-expression. For all his elements would be carried to a highest degree and integrated in some kind of comprehensive largeness. What we are striving towards is completeness in harmony. An imperfection and incapacity or a discord of our nature is that from which inwardly we must suffer. But this is because of our incompleteness of being, our imperfect self-knowledge, our imperfect possession of ourself and our nature. A complete self-knowledge in all things and at all moments is the gift of the supramental gnosis, and with it a complete self-mastery, not merely in the sense of control of nature, but in the sense of a power of perfect self-expression in nature. Whatever knowledge of self there would be perfectly embodied in the will of the self. The will perfectly embodied in the action of the self. The result would be the self's complete dynamic self-formulation in its own nature. In the lower grades of Gnostic being, there would be a limitation of self-expression according to the variety of the nature. A limited perfection in order to formulate some side element, a combined harmony of elements of some divine totality. A restricted selection of powers from the cosmic figure of the infinitely manifold one. But in the supramental being, this need of limitation for perfection would disappear. The diversity would not be secured by limitation, but by a diversity in the power and hue of the supernature. Same whole of being and the same whole of nature would express themselves in an infinitely diverse fashion. Each be a new totality, harmony, self-equation of the one being. What would be expressed in front or held behind at any moment would depend not on capacity or incapacity, but on the dynamic self-choice of the spirit, its delight of self-expression, on the truth of the divine's will and joy of itself in the individual, and, subordinately, on the truth of the thing that had to be done through the individual in the harmony of the totality. For the complete individual is the cosmic individual, since only when we have taken the universe into ourselves and transcended it, can our individuality be complete.
So here, Sri Aurobindo is continuing along the same lines that we had talked about, and he is looking at the individual existence as not being abrogated in any way, but being fulfilled in the Gnostic realization. So this fulfillment is coming from what he points out to be the need of fulfillment of the individual, which is the growth towards completeness and harmony. These two factors ultimately realize individual fulfillment in the cosmic existence. The individual feels incomplete because its powers are constantly challenged by difference, other powers around it, that difference in kind, and by difference in degree, that is, powers that are greater or lesser than it. So these kinds of differences that surround the individual cause it to feel threatened or incomplete, unfulfilled, not potent to deal with its world. So this is what causes growth of individual consciousness is actually motivated from within as part of the evolution of the psychic being towards universality. Universality at the individual level implies that there is movement towards fullness of its own nature. Self nature, swabhava, comes to a certain kind of universal fullness. In that universal fullness, there is a sense of a certain type of universality. Each individual arrives at a certain type of individuality. However, that type of individuality sees itself as a certain form of individuality, not identical to other forms of individuality. This is one of the limitations of overmind. That's why overmind is often spoken of as the world of the gods. The gods are each complete and fulfilled in themselves. Each one of the gods is the cosmic Purusha, cosmic being in itself. And yet, each is a certain representation of the totality. The totality as a certain representation. In their multiple reality, they form a harmony. So this is where completeness and harmony are the two powers of individual fulfillment. They know themselves each to be the totality, and yet acknowledge other forms of totality by being in harmony with them. This is at the heights of overmental experience. But the supermind goes one step further in that if we talk about completeness and harmony as two kinds of degrees of unity, the supermind is represented by identity, which is transcendental to harmony. It is the sense of the one possessing the infinite, manifesting the infinite in its differentiated forms, maintaining them in harmony as forms of the one, and deploying them actively as individual selections of the one. In all these operations, the identity is not lost. Therefore, it is not that there is a realization of totality and at the same time of difference, a selection of totality and at the same time of difference, but rather there is a knowledge of identity dynamically manifesting itself as difference. So this is the big, difference between Gnostic existence and cosmic existence or individual existence.
So in the overmental gods, there is a good sense of separateness between the individual beings.
Yeah, there is a sense that each is a totality in itself, that the totality can be manifest or expressed in each of its forms. And hence, other forms are known to be forms of the same, and yet not forms into which one can merge in identity. Mm-hmm. It is as if the power by which that identity can be known exists outside that cosmic formulation. Cosmic formulation is allowing infinity to manifest as forms of totality at the summits of your mind.
So when if it is not the gods, if it is individual sadhaks or individual beings from the earth consciousness who are aspiring and who are reaching that overmental planes, so then they stay there, but by aspiration they go past it as well, whereas the gods, they are content there and do not go past. Is that what the gist is?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually the progress of the gods also depends on the progress of individual souls in their ability to grow into identity with the gods at the level of the overmind and then cross beyond into the home of identity from where everything can be seen as dynamically maintained forms of the one. Now, this is very interesting in the sense of the individual growth, but also in larger entities and the evolution of the cosmos. Cosmic evolution and individual evolution both are occurring through soul forms of the cosmic being. The cosmic being is representing itself in all these various soul forms and down to the individual psychic being. But then there are also other soul forms, other psychic formations, such as nation souls, if you want to think about that, or group souls. Now, these nation souls or group souls have similar distinction or selection of being. Now, the select forms of experiencing being grow in time, and that growth is essentially one in which they move towards fulfillment or completion of that combination of forces that represents them. Now, in that growth, it cannot rest until it knows the universal in its own way. That is the entire thing about individual progress. moving towards the cosmic or the universal, each comes to know the universal in its own way. And in doing that, one may say, arrives at a certain godhood. That godhood is one of the various gods of the world of the gods. See, so each nation, each human individual, each collective entity is in travail, one may say, to realize that particular, you know, status of godhood, a universality in its unique way. So that's the progress of the soul. But in the supermind, one further step is crossed and it is realized to be the one being that is in all these beings and in all these forms, forming the entire play and maintaining it dynamically for its delight.
So when we say Parabrahman, is that where does that come in here, or is that orthogonal to it?
Yeah, Parabrahman would be the supramental existence
okay.
over here.
Okay.
Parabrahman would constitute the knowledge realm, the realm of Vidya.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Devashish.
Including the supermind and Satchidananda.
Okay. Shall we read the next one?
Sure.
Louise, would you agree?
Sure. The supermental being in his cosmic consciousness, seeing and feeling all as himself, would act in that sense. He would act in a universal awareness and a harmony of his individual self with the total self of his individual will, with the total will of his individual action, with the total action. For what we most suffer from in our outer life and its reactions upon our inner life is imperfection of our relations with the world, our ignorance of others, our disharmony with the whole of things, our inability to equate our demand on the world with the world's demand on us. There is a conflict from which there seems to be no ultimate issue except an escape from both world and self, between our self-affirmation and a world on which we have to impose that affirmation, a world which seems to be too large for us and to pass indifferently over our soul, mind, life, body in the sweep of its course to its goal. The relation of our course and goal to the worlds is unapparent to us, and to harmonize ourselves with it, we have either to enforce ourselves upon it and make it subservient to us, or suppress ourselves and become subservient to it, or else to compass a difficult balance between these two necessities of the relation between the individual personal destiny and the cosmic whole and its hidden purpose. But for the supermental being living in a cosmic consciousness, the difficulty would not exist. Since he has no ego, his cosmic individuality would know the cosmic forces and their movement and their significance as part of himself, and truth consciousness in him would see the right relation at each step and find the dynamic right expression of that relation.
So here he's again bringing out that dichotomy between the cosmic being and the individual self, known separately as separate existences. See, there is a yearning towards the cosmic in the individual. At the level of the ego, that is what makes us want to either possess things and therefore equate the world with ourselves, or to obliterate things which we can't possess, to destroy that which will not identify with us, and therefore to reduce the world to ourselves. Otherwise, there is the opposite, which is the sense of obliterating oneself in the face of the world. That is, as he says, submitting to it, to become insignificant as an individual. The modern world is one in which largely the place of the individual has been made insignificant, and only a few move in this other gigantic direction and occupy positions of immense control, which tend towards the limit condition of possessing the whole world. That's the direction of the tremendously monopolistic businesses and politics of today's world. But the thing that he's pointing out over here is that, as a matter of fact, all this is really the action of the one. And if there is that dimension that emerges in our awareness in a form of consciousness, then we don't see the individual and the cosmos as pitted against one another, but as forms of the one. The individual is himself the cosmos. The cosmic being and the individual being are not separate. And therefore, there is a knowledge that other constituents of the cosmic being are also oneself. Now, the Gita, this is why the Gita gives this very practical direction to achieve this kind of experience through action, through works. And it says that what he points out over here, he says, we have either to enforce ourselves upon it, that is the world, and make it subservient to us, or suppress ourselves, become subservient to it, or else to compass a difficult balance between these two necessities of the relation between the individual personal destiny and the cosmic whole and its hidden purpose. See, this idea of the cosmic whole and its hidden purpose is made the lever for the Gita in the growth of the individual towards its own knowledge of identity with the universal. So what is known as working without desire for the fruits of action proceeds along this direction, where there is an acknowledgement of the fact that whatever my little ignorant ego may think about the value of the result of my action, the same action has a completely different value as far as the cosmic workings are concerned. My success may mean nothing to the cosmic works, may mean something to the cosmic works which is good, or may actually mean something terrible to the cosmic works. I have no way of knowing that. All I can know is what it means to me. Now, if instead of thinking about my own good or bad, I were to think that every person who puts any output into this world is actually an agent or instrument of the divine, and is a divine worker in every being that is actually working for the cosmic good, then we find that we can surrender the sense of the fruit to that purpose. I don't know what the divine is achieving through me, but I am an instrument for the divine's work in the world. Therefore, the fruit does not belong to me, it belongs to the divine. This becomes the meditation. This becomes the sense of will with which the Gita enjoins works in the world. Now, if this is practiced, carried out, then gradually the perception of the individual becomes one in which he or she begins to see that the cosmic being is at work in the world. The cosmic being is working through oneself, and the cosmic being is working through others as well. This intuitive perception begins to emerge. Eventually, this is what will yield the experience of cosmic existence in the individual. The individual being an actor of the cosmic existence. And even further, this will yield the experience of the one being who has become both cosmos and individual. That is the Gnostic being.
So are you using in this case the cosmic worker or the cosmic being that's doing the work is, are you saying it's same as the Gnostic being, or I didn't understand the difference ever either?
The cosmic being or the cosmic worker, let's say like what the Gita is pulling us towards experiencing, is what Sri Aurobindo elsewhere also calls the active Brahman. The active Brahman can also be called the divine Shakti. So it's this divine Shakti, but not the divine Shakti at first of the supermind, rather the overmental Shakti that one starts becoming aware of. Now, what I'm pointing to is that he's saying that that ultimately yields a certain realization in which individual and cosmos are seen as related to one another. That the individual is an aspect of the cosmic working. But even further, there is the realization of the Gnostic being in which the cosmic working and the individual are both seen in all cases to be identical, to be the one being. So these are two stages towards the realization of the Gnostic being.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishtha. So that's a, just like before we get to the cosmic being, we see it as separate, then even farther is the same realization about both the cosmic worker and the individual worker. That
right,
even that cosmic worker also was, so to say, an illusion.
Yeah, cosmic worker was also a certain formulation, just as the individual was a formulation, a dynamic formulation of the one being who remains the one being in the individual and the cosmos without ever changing its own, you know, sort of nature in either. Mm-hmm. The totality of the one, of the infinite one, is present in the cosmos and in each of its parts.
Sure.
The harmonization of the individual and the cosmic being, you see, in an overmental realization, brings us the awareness that the individual is a part of the cosmos. Mm-hmm. But the realization of the Gnostic being brings us the realization that the cosmos and the individual are each the whole of the Gnostic being.
So then at that point, there are really, I mean, both these, all these statuses are simultaneously held, that it can identify itself as the individual as well as the cosmic and detach from both as itself. Is that correct?
Correct. And it does all these simultaneously, right?
Uh-huh. And similarly in the cosmic, can it do
not
both?
Not only can, but does.
Okay. And similarly, in the cosmic realization also, does it have statuses of both the realization simultaneously of the individual and the cosmic, or is it more of one merging into the other and realizing the other was an illusion, so to say?
It can have both simultaneously, but usually what happens in the overmind, there is a tendency to empower one over the other.
Okay.
That's why the philosophies have arisen, in which you find each one trying to reduce the other to a function of itself.
Oh.
But what Sri Aurobindo is pointing out, that these can coexist, but there is a certain kind of a gap between them. It's almost like different dimensions. That's why last time we were talking about dimensions. There are different dimensions. Each perceives the other as an aspect of itself. But it's only when the Gnostic existence is experienced that sense of gap completely disappears, and each is seen to be the same, being maintained by the will of the Gnostic being.
Devashish?
Yeah.
The will of the Gnostic being would be saying that that's the same as the will of the divine?
Yeah, absolutely. The will of the supreme, if you want to call it that.
Yes.
See, there is a divine will in the world which could be called the cosmic will. But when we are talking of the Gnostic will is, of course, the Gnostic will, the cosmic will is embodying the Gnostic will. But the Gnostic will is something more than the cosmic will. It is more than the cosmic will in its knowledge of dynamically creating everything. Even like let me give you an analogy that becomes more clear when we think about the inconscient. So the inconscient seems to our consciousness to be a fixed reality. In other words, it seems as if an automatism of Prakriti, fixed forever, has given matter its present form. It's so stable that we cannot even comprehend the possibility that its laws can be changed. By cosmic will, these are the forms of law which have been created and put in motion that will remain like that forever. See? It's like a tapas of the cosmic Purusha. But by same thing seen from the viewpoint of the Gnostic will, this is being dynamically maintained. In other words, each law is up for grabs at every moment. And it is only the active or dynamic will of the Gnostic being that is keeping it in a constant form. See?
Would the will of the Gnostic being be aware of what the fruits of its work are?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's the united, it's the one being. You know, for that matter, even the will of the cosmic being is aware of what the fruits of its works are.
So there'll never be a question of what to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Vince, did you want to say anything more? Or? So, Devashish, Sri Aurobindo talks of, you know, in the ascent that there are three, four kinds of forces that prevent the progress, which is the universal nature, then the hostile forces, and the divine forces themselves that, you know, put in their tests, quote-unquote tests to, you know, before the aspirant is allowed to, you know, quote-unquote cross over. So, in these ranges, are those same kind of forces acting as well?
No, you mean at the level of the Gnostic consciousness?
Yeah, both. Not Gnostic, but at the cosmic, you know, in the over-mental planes.
Yeah, over-mental planes, some of them are active, but some of them are not. Like hostile beings are no longer active over here. Or if they are active, then they don't really have any effect over here. They have the effect in the lower ranges. But nevertheless, they can't be, you see, if there are hostile forces, they can't be destroyed over here. I mean, they can't have effect over here, but they can't be removed or destroyed over here. They will continue to have their effects at lower levels. At the Gnostic kind of level of Gnostic consciousness, they can be transformed or removed at every sort of level of the universal existence.
Uh-huh. Oh. So when you say that, which it kind of leads me on to, so when we say, in this case, when we talk of the Gnostic being, we are only talking of the rise to the that supramental heights, right? Are we also talking of the descent of the supramental force to the lower nature and transforming it?
Yeah, we're talking about that as well. We're talking about the action of this Gnostic will in the universe or in the universal consciousness, so that whether we rise to it or even after we rise to it, the individual may rise to it, but the action of the Gnostic will as part of the transformation of the individual will start acting in the cosmos as well. So this is exactly why the whole thing is almost like a recursive relation, in which if an individual achieves the whole, every individual also has the same process multiplied in itself. Mm-hmm. Now, that multiplication involves choice. It isn't that it kind of occurs like a kind of determinism, but nevertheless, it doesn't complete itself until and unless that choice is mobilized in every individual. So, descent of the supramental will, on the Gnostic will, as an aspect of an individual's sadhana, is something which also starts exerting its effects upon every other individual, moving towards their own sadhana.
Devashish? Mm-hmm. That descent and ascent, that continues even in a supermind.
Sure.
But isn't that a duality? Wouldn't there be a trinity
It is a duality, Vince. But duality is the very condition of all manifestation. Duality is not necessarily, bad, because without duality you can't have any manifestation.
Right.
So the only difference is that, like he points out, there is a certain kind of progress from ignorance to knowledge, and another kind of progress from knowledge to greater knowledge. So, the law is, the nature of the law is different, but nevertheless there is still progress, and there's still ascents and descents.
Well, thank you. I know there's this connection between monism and dualism and I have a little trouble getting my mind around that dualities aren't necessarily dualism.
Yeah, dualities are dualisms, but at this level you have what is, what's called bheda-bheda condition. That is, dual and non-dual at the same time.
At the same time.
Yeah.
Bheda-bheda. Advaita-vedantism or something.
It's a kind of vedantism, which is dual and non-dual at the same time.
Yes, I remember that.
Or Dvaita-Dvaita, as it is called.
Yes. Well, thank you again.
Jyoti, do you want to read next?
Sure. My fan is going to make a lot of noise, sorry about that. Okay. For in fact, both individual and universe are simultaneous and interrelated expressions of the same transcendent being. Even though in the ignorance and under its law there is maladjustment and conflict, yet there must be a right relation. And an equation to which all arrives, but which is missed by our blindness of ego, our attempt to affirm the ego and not the self, one in all. The supramental consciousness has that truth of relation in itself as its natural right and privilege, since it is the supermind that determines the cosmic relations and the relations of the individual with the universe. determines them freely and sovereignly, has a power of the transcendence. In the mental being, even the pressure of the cosmic consciousness overpowering the ego and an awareness of the transcendent reality might not of themselves bring about a dynamic solution, for there might still be an incompatibility between its liberated spiritual mentality and the obscure life of the cosmic ignorance, which the mind would not have the power to solve or overcome. But in the supramental being, not only statically conscious but fully dynamic and acting in the creative light and power of the transcendence, the supramental light, the truth light, Ritam Jyoti, would have that power. For there would be a unity with the cosmic self, but not a bondage to the ignorance of cosmic nature in its lower formulation. There would, on the contrary, be a power to act in the light of the truth on that ignorance. A large universality of self-expression, a large harmonic universality of world-being would be the very sign of the supramental person in his Gnostic nature.
So this is a further elaboration of the same and of something that we were just discussing, which is that in the cosmic condition, there may be the ability to overcome or escape from the action of the hostile forces, the ignorant nature or the falsehood, but not the ability to change its law. Therefore, there won't be a kind of transformation of the cosmos possible through that kind of realization. The individual might be liberated and might have the experience of something which is beyond ignorance and falsehood, but at the same time, it would not be able to be effective against such things in the cosmos. And therefore, this disproportion between the individual and the cosmos would remain in that sense. It would be able to accept the existence of ignorance and falsehood in the cosmos as part of the natural workings of the cosmos, of the one will in the cosmos. So that acceptance would be there. Again, it is like knowing that one is in a certain kind of play, accepting the conditions of that play. The play has in it elements that are undesirable, but nevertheless, those are just conditions of the play and one is free from the play. One may still be a player, but one is a wise player in that one sees through the masks of the play. This is a condition of the over-mental realization. But on the other hand, in the supramental realization, one has the ability to change the game, change the name of the play, as it were. See, the cosmic law, the law of oneness, of knowledge, all as identity, as being maintained by the will of the Gnostic being, could impose itself upon the play so that it doesn't need the disguises of ignorance and falsehood. So that is where Sri Aurobindo struck upon this particular solution as the only one by which the conditions of the world ignorance could be transformed. This is why it's so important in Sri Aurobindo's teaching or his darshan to acknowledge this idea of the supermind and its distinction. He goes into pains to bring it out. You find this very well brought out in the canto on the triple soul forces of Savitri. There we find Savitri in search of her soul is ascending into this cosmic soul region. Savitri being an avatar is actually coming across the archetypal beings, the goddess beings of the overmind, established here in the ignorance. As she encounters each one of them, what she encounters is a goddess, all right, who is free and completely embodying one particular idea totally of the cosmos, and yet it always comes with a double. That double is its distorted and false shadow in the cosmic ignorance. This distorted shadow can do nothing about. It has to live with it. It is tied to it, shackled to it. And that particular existence, double existence, can only be overcome if the conditions of the ignorance are completely, you know, transcended, and some new Shakti, new goddess, new power enters that sees that these particular powers in their action are not stuck to a certain law, but that the law itself can be changed. See? Because the law is being maintained as an act of tapas of the cosmic being. That act of tapas, the cosmic being cannot change. Only the Gnostic being can change the form of the tapas of the cosmic being.
So this changing of the form, this changing of the form is what, of the tapas is what is being called as transformation, is it?
Yeah, exactly. In fact, because it's actually a change of the form of the cosmic being, Sri Aurobindo uses an enigmatic phrase in certain places where he says, talks of supramentalizing the overmind. The idea of supramentalizing the overmind is just that. That the overmind represents the cosmic law, the law of ignorance and evolving ignorance. And the supermind, supramentalizing the overmind, is the idea of changing that particular law so that a new kind of law expresses itself in the cosmos. A law of the supermind, which is the Gnostic being, the law of the Gnostic being, the will of the Gnostic being.
So that's
not veiled behind disguises of ignorance and falsehood.
And so that's really the removal of that veil, when we say the overmind there is a veil has been put, is that symbolic or? I guess, what is a symbol, right?
Yeah, exactly. What is a symbol? Everything is a symbol.
Yeah,
from a certain point of view,
uh-huh.
The entire manifestation forms the representations of the unrepresentable.
Yeah.
Therefore, everything is a symbol.
Mm-hmm.
Symbol, a reality, a symbol reality. What Sri Aurobindo calls the real idea.
Yeah. Devashish.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that veil be the shadow?
He uses the term shadow in a number of ways, but the term, the veil, would really be what he's calling the overmind Maya. So he's talking about two kinds of Maya, which again reflect as the two kinds of Prakriti. The two forms of Maya, the overmind Maya and the supramental Maya. The overmind Maya, what he calls the lower Maya and the higher Maya. The overmind Maya is the veil of ignorance and falsehood. But yeah, that is what casts the shadow into the ignorance so as to, you know, darken it. And that so-called darkness, the quote-unquote darkness, is the fixity of the law. The lower we go in the rungs of manifestation, becomes more and more fixed. So that fixity ultimately expresses itself as matter with its unchanging laws, what Sri Aurobindo calls the iron law.
And the only way to change, I mean, Gnostic being would be the agent of that.
Right, the
Gnostic being.
Yeah. See, so if we actually look at nature, we find that the laws of nature are really fixed the lower we go. In matter, we have absolutely fixed laws of nature. Of course, when you probe it sufficiently, you start finding all kinds of inconsistencies and mysteries there as well. But nevertheless, the macroscopic world is made up of these fixed laws that don't seem to have any possibility of change. And then you have laws of life which have more flexibility and freedom to them. The soul element starts emerging with its possibility of freedom. The laws of mind express greater amount of freedom. And then the laws of spirit are where the soul can be free from the determinisms of nature. But that individual freedom still cannot do anything to the laws of life or the laws of matter. They remain sort of laws which are fixed and rigid. But if one rises into the supermind, one finds that these laws are upheld dynamically. It's really by will of the supermind that the laws appear to be laws at all. And therefore, their nature as law can be completely transformed so that they become transparent manifestations of the oneness of consciousness.
So, in 1956, when the descent of the supermind into the earth consciousness, so what has happened there? Is it that the supermind is now acting in the, it has reached the overmental planes of the earth, I don't know if you can say of the earth, or has it come further down, or what has, what is the significance of that in relation to what we're talking about just now?
Well, one doesn't really know exactly what is the relationship between what that means and what we're talking about right now. The one thing one can say is that what it implies is that to supramental consciousness, the condition of ignorance in which we live is no longer a necessity. In other words, that very iron law that we talked about is also a dynamically upheld choice of the supermind in the universe itself. Now, you may say that was always the case. Mm-hmm. That's true, but that was a veiled reality.
Sure.
Now,
sure.
In under the present circumstances, it is a willed reality in the cosmos itself. Mm-hmm. Now, we may ask, why is it so willed? If the supermind is here, why don't we have a miraculous and sort of completely delightful condition on Earth? Nothing seems much to have changed since 1956.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one can say, we read last time itself that there is a long and slow preparation to supermind, to whoever can possibly experience or realize the action of supermind. It might be very different. It might be that tremendous promise has opened up. But for it to be realized, human consciousness has to make a lot of progress, and that preparation has to be achieved.
Mm-hmm.
So how long will that preparation take? That is something inconceivable at our level. But maybe that is what is necessary before, you know, that so-called transparent, you know, unveiling can occur.
Yeah.
See, the even the supramental creation is one in which human will is involved.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, as the mother says, if it was entirely up to the human will, it would take thousands of years. There would be no need for this intervention. The idea of an intervention would be unnecessary if it was entirely up to human will. See, we just have to wait till human choice matured sufficiently and this happened. But the difference is that now there is a power which is acting upon human beings as well as the cosmos to move it in certain directions. Still human choice is involved, but the choice is being assisted in a very significant way, in a very powerful way. The preparation may be much longer than we think. Based on our sort of small vision of things, it's only this power that knows how long the preparation and what the need of that preparation is for a cosmic change to take place.
Yeah, thank you, Devashishtha. Vince, would you like to read next?
Hi, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. Sorry, my cat just... I gotta get him out of here. One second. And feed it. Okay. What are the beginning words?
The existence of the supramental being, the play of the manifold.
The existence of the supramental being will be the play of a manifoldly and multiply manifesting truth power of one existence and one consciousness for the delight of one existence. Delight of the manifestation of the spirit in its truth of being would be the sense of the Gnostic life. All its movements would be a formulation of the truth of the spirit, but also of the joy of the spirit. In affirmation of spiritual existence, in affirmation of spiritual consciousness, in affirmation of spiritual delight of being. But could not be what self-affirmation tends to be in us, in spite of the underlying unity, something egocentric, separative, opposed, or indifferent, or insufficiently alive to the self-affirmation of others, or their demand on existence. One in self with all, the supramental being will seek the delight of self-manifestation of the spirit in himself, but equally the delight of the divine in all. He will have the cosmic joy and will be a power for bringing the bliss of the spirit, the joy of being, to others. For their joy will be part of his own joy of existence. To be occupied with the good of all beings, to make the joy and grief of others one's own, has been described as a sign of the liberated and fulfilled spiritual man. The supramental being will have no need for that of an altruistic self-effacement, since this occupation will be intimate to his self-fulfillment. the fulfillment of the one in all. And there will be no contradiction or strife between his own good and the good of others. Nor will he have any need to acquire a universal sympathy by subjecting himself to the joys and griefs of creatures in the ignorance. His cosmic sympathy will be part of his inborn truth of being and not dependent on a personal participation in the lesser joy and suffering. It will transcend what it embraces, and in that transcendence will be its power. His feeling of universality, his action of universality, will be always a spontaneous state in natural movement, an automatic expression of the truth, an act of the joy of the spirit's self-existence. There could be in it no place for limited self or desire, or for the satisfaction or frustration of limited self, or the satisfaction or frustration of desire. No place for the relative and dependent happiness and grief that visit and afflict our limited nature. For these are things that belong to the ego and the ignorance, not to the freedom and truth of the spirit.
So here he's talking about this completeness of the individual life as one which necessarily takes every element of the cosmos into itself. This is what we were discussing earlier also, as that fact that one being entering into the Gnostic existence and bringing it into the cosmic would not only begin to effect a transformative force in one's own life, but also in the cosmos, in everything around, in every being. So he points out that this is not that rising in the ignorance to a sense of cosmic sympathy, but the descending power of an innate sympathy, a universal sympathy, that arises from the sense of oneness. This sympathy is transformative. It is transformative because it is transcendental. And we may again get a hint of what this is when we recognize the fact that instead of widening one's experience by becoming other experiences in the ignorant universe, this would impose the sense of oneness upon other experiences. In its identification with other forms of consciousness in the universe, it would see itself as the one, assuming its various parts. In that assumption, it would transform. It would bring the power of the one. So this is exactly how the transformation would proceed dynamically in the willing of supramental oneness upon all that is touched. Now, again, over here, the question that was raised by Shyam comes in, which is that the supramental consciousness, acting as a kind of universal consciousness in the ignorance, preparing the ground, can also have this type of effect to a degree. But it is only when it becomes manifest in agents, in personal agents, in individuals that can embody it, that its effect becomes most accelerated and powerful, potent. This is the reason why it's people like Sri Aurobindo and the mother, when they were in their body, that the acceleration of this process of cosmic transformation was so much greater. Their leaving of the body hasn't stopped the process, but certainly it waits or awaits other beings to give that kind of personal manifestation to its action, to whatever extent they can, as part of the cosmic working.
So, one of the questions that arises is, you know, how do you combine the fact that the supermind has a divine will as well as the fact that it has no need?
How do you mean, Shyam? Because to me it seems as the very definition of the divine will. The divine will has no need.
Okay. It's only in the lower nature that the need is the impetus for the will.
Right, exactly. So divine will is one which affects itself as a kind of form of being. The divine will sees itself everywhere. It isn't motivated by a need. It just manifests in its manifestation wherever it sees that it is not manifest. It transforms and becomes itself.
So maybe we are talking about semantics here, Devajita, but what is, at that point, what's the difference between a will and what's the difference between the will and the force? They are both the same, isn't it?
Well, the difference would be, at a certain level there is no difference, but the difference would be that a force doesn't necessarily have a conscious agent. A will does.
Okay.
But of course, as I said, at a certain level, every force has a conscious agent. But in the veiled reality, there are many kinds of forces at work that don't seem to have any conscious agent.
Yavashish?
Yeah.
What you saying a bit back about Sri Aurobindo and the mother not having their, you know, when they were in the body, they could affect the transformation. Makes me kind of, Sri Aurobindo said he'd be back in the first supramental body, born in the supramental way, whatever that means. But what do you think? You think the mother will be back before then?
Well, it's very difficult to say when.
Yes, I know. It's kind of a wish.
There are people who have said things of that nature. For example, Nolinida sort of said something like that, that before Sri Aurobindo comes in the first supramental body, the mother will come one more time. Now, you know, these are, kind of predictive statements that only people in that particular kind of echelon of consciousness can probably make. And even there, we have to take it with a pinch of salt.
Yes.
Because who knows whether it's true or not. But this much one can say, that whatever it is, that, like you said, you know, they were here. I mean, this is like an amazing historical kind of, you know, manifestation of beings who effected something stupendous in Earth consciousness. But whatever they did, perhaps, was to prepare the ground for humans to be able to embody some forms of consciousness that they never did before. So, you know, there's no doubt, looking back in time, you see people like Sri Aurobindo and the mother superhuman. You know, in a lifetime, for human beings to achieve what they achieved, is not something conceivable. most of it was, you know, like he said, his life was not lived on the surface or meant to see. Most of it was completely incomprehensible to the Milu that were around them. So, you know, I think the real thing is, whatever they have achieved has perhaps made it possible for humankind in the future to understand a little bit in experience what it meant to be Sri Aurobindo or to be the mother. Maybe that is what, you know, the whole floodgates opening into the future are all about. And maybe it's only when that has achieved itself to a certain degree that the possibility of their return comes in.
Yeah, I kind of hope that I'll be there when she's here again. That'd be nice.
Sure.
Where did Nalini say that, Devashish? I'd like to read that.
You know, he didn't. I don't know whether he ever wrote it. I don't think he wrote it. I heard it from his secretary. She was, you know, and I've heard it from others, but I heard it directly from Animadi, who he apparently said this to. Of course, one can always question whether, you know, each person down, there is not a distortion of some kind that takes place. But, you know, I mean, she was of another very upstanding nature. Her own consciousness was perhaps less, you know, sort of questionable than many other normal human beings.
Luis, would you like to read next?
Okay. Okay, but don't kill me. Is it the an evolution of Gnostic consciousness?
The previous one.
Okay. An evolution of Gnostic consciousness brings with it...
The previous one.
I'm sorry?
I believe it's the previous one.
Uh-oh. Oh, yeah, you're right. Sorry, I jumped. The Gnostic being has the will of action, but also the knowledge of what is to be willed and the power to effectuate its knowledge. It will not be led from ignorance to do what is not to be done. Moreover, its action is not the seeking for a fruit or result. Its joy is in being and doing, in pure state of spirit, in pure act of spirit, in the pure bliss of the spirit. As its static consciousness will contain all in itself and must be, therefore, forever self-fulfilled, so its dynamis of consciousness will find in each step and in each act a spiritual freedom and a self-fulfillment. All will be seen in its relation to the whole, so that each step will be luminous and joyous and satisfying in itself, because each is in unison with a luminous totality. This consciousness, this living in the spiritual totality and acting from it, a satisfied totality in essence of being and a satisfied totality in the dynamic movement of being, the sense of relations of that totality accompanying each step is indeed the very mark of a supramental consciousness and distinguishes it from the disintegrated, ignorantly successive steps of our consciousness in the ignorance. The Gnostic existence and delight of existence is a universal and total being and delight, and there will be the presence of that totality and universality in each separate movement. In each there will be not a partial experience of self or a fractional bit of its joy, but the sense of the whole movement of an integral being and the presence of its entire and integral bliss of being, Ananda. The Gnostic being's knowledge, self-realized in action, will be not an ideative knowledge, but the real idea of the supermind, the instrumentation of an essential light of consciousness. It will be the self-light of all the reality of being and becoming, pouring itself out continually and filling every particular act and activity with a pure and whole delight of its self-existence. For an infinite consciousness with its knowledge by identity, there is in each differentiation the joy and experience of identical. In each finite is felt the infinite.
So this is in a way a translation in terms of time of what Sri Aurobindo has already established in terms of space. That in every part of itself, the whole is present. It is acting out of a totality of consciousness in which each part knows that it is the whole altogether, and at the same time that it is every other part in that whole. That knowledge of its totality allows this particular will to be a will of perfect harmony, because it is only the one will in all things, known to be the one will in each, in every action. So that can be its understanding in terms of space, but each one of its particles, each one of its parts in its actions in time, the successions of its actions that he's talking about over here, works in a similar fashion in knowing the totality of the actions possible and knowing therefore what exactly to mobilize from moment to moment. In a way, you know, to understand this is very difficult, but also human beings have been given certain forms of experience by which analogous kinds of, you know, experiences can be asserted. See, one of them is the experience of creativity. You know, we can sense in creative moments that there is what may be called an intensification of consciousness. Once consciousness is more self-gathered, one is more totally oneself. There is a sense of the totality of one's being that is present to one in heightened moments of creativity. There is also a sense of the totality of what is being created present all at once in every moment of the creation. This particular aspect of the creative act is something which allows for a certain kind of miraculous unity to exist in high works of creativity. You know, the creator starts off and sort of follows a succession of steps. But once the work is over, for the person who is reading a poem or looking at a piece of art or listening to a piece of music, there is an enormous unity which one feels, particularly in, you know, works of, you know, high creative power, that is present throughout the piece of work. In the practice of creative arts, one seems to feel as if the totality of the idea is present, and at each moment there is the whole is trying to press itself into manifestation, and yet there is the choice of some specific thing in the whole that is the right thing at the right place. So these kinds of experiences give us a hint of the nature of supramental existence. The oneness in space and the oneness in time and the identity of being in both.
Devashish?
Yeah.
One time when I was in looking at the Matramandia, I had a feeling that you know, I've had some nice meditations there, and that I'll be back many times in the future to meditate there in many lives. And I had, you know, I felt a little bit of what you were just talking about. I mean, in the sense of this succession of lives, given the kind of a freedom to detach and
I know what you're talking about.
What's happening? Yeah, yeah.
It's as if though this object is present in front of you at a certain moment in time, there is an aspect of it like a door which opens into its eternal existence, and you sense it to straddle many times, and you're present in many times with it. I don't know if I'm expressing myself right, but this is similar to that heightening of consciousness.
Yeah, that's what I was,
Exactly.
Excuse me, go ahead, sorry.
No, I exactly resonate with you in this kind of experience that you're talking about.
Shall I read the next one? Cool. Shall I read the next one?
Sure.
An evolution of Gnostic consciousness brings with it a transformation of our world consciousness and world action. For it takes up into the new power of awareness not only the inner existence, but our outer being and our world being. There is a remaking of both, an integration of them in the sense and power of the spiritual existence. There must come upon us in the change at once a reversal and rejection of our present way of existence and a fulfillment of its inner trend and tendency. For we stand now between these two terms, an outer world of life and matter that has made us and a remaking of the world by ourselves in the sense of the evolving spirit. Our present way of living is at once a subjection to life force and matter and a struggle with life and matter. In its first appearance, an outer existence creates by our reactions to it an inner or mental existence. If we shape ourselves at all, it is in most men less by the conscious pressure of free soul or intelligence from within than by a response to our environment and the world nature acting upon us. But what we move towards in the development of our conscious being is an inner existence creating by its knowledge and power its own outer form of living and self-expressive environment of living. In the Gnostic nature, this movement will have consummated itself. The nature of living will be an accomplished inner existence whose light and power will take perfect body in the outer life. The Gnostic being will take up the world of life and matter, but he will turn and adapt it to his own truth and purpose of existence. He will mold life itself into his own spiritual image, and this he will be able to do because he has the secret of a spiritual creation and is in communion and oneness with the Creator within him. This will be first effective in the shaping of his own inner and outer individual existence. But the same power and principle will operate in any common Gnostic life. The relations of Gnostic being with Gnostic being will be the expression of their own Gnostic self and supernature, shaping into a significant power and form of itself the whole common existence.
By the way, that last sentence was, the relations of Gnostic being with Gnostic being with the expression of their one Gnostic self and supernature, shaping into a significant power and form of itself the whole common existence. That of the one Gnostic self is a very key one, because what represents the Gnostic, the divine life, which is the whole thesis of this particular work, and you know the essence of the Gnostic being, is that all these Gnostic beings simultaneously experience their oneness.
Mm-hmm.
It is the one being in many beings. And that is experienced, that's why it's a different species. The modality of the species is different, just as mental beings in an animal world represented different form of experience.
Sure.
So two supramental beings in a mental world represent a different form of experience, a form of experience in which the one being is experienced in many beings simultaneously. Each one knows himself to be that one in oneself and in others. And that is the experience of the interaction. You know, there is a simultaneous knowledge that is, you know, at work in every interaction. So that is a very powerful sort of thing that he's talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, of course, is this idea of the reversal of consciousness. Sri Aurobindo uses this term in a variety of contexts, but this is the major reversal of consciousness, where that which has prepared us, the consciousness of matter and life, are molding in the forms so that the soul may emerge in it, has now reached the point where it can itself be remade. Its very conditions of existence can be transformed. So that possibility is now made into an actuality by the descending supramental consciousness. Now it points out that that is achieved first in the individual by remolding of the inner and the outer individual life. But then that is extended into the environment, into other lives, because having that universal sympathy that he talked about and the power over nature that this implies in the exercise over one's own consciousness, that can be extended to world nature, can be extended to other human beings' nature. So there, that's again where we were talking about the fact that supramental consciousness diffused into the earth consciousness has a certain kind of preparatory work, but it is only when it is embodied in human beings that the reversal of consciousness can start working. Because it is by choice of soul choice, that these transformative acts can start changing, you know, others as well as one's environment, oneself, one's environment, and the world.
Could you also talk about the lines, the last few lines in the previous page, where he says it's less by the conscious pressure of a free soul or intelligence from within than by a response to our environment and the world nature acting upon us?
Sorry, Sham, I was muted. Where is it in the last paragraph?
In the previous, the last few lines of the previous page, 977.
It is the same paragraph.
Yeah, the same paragraph.
Okay, what is it?
In its first appearance, an outer existence creates by our reactions to it an inner or mental existence. If we shape ourselves at all, it is in most men less by the conscious pressure of a free soul or intelligence from within than by a response to our environment and the world nature acting upon us.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, so you see, what he's talking about again is the same. I mean, how human subjects are created. You know, we are molded by, you know, life forces, matter forces, life forces and mind forces. And we are given a certain kind of shape. This kind of understanding is also true of the social world.
Mm-hmm.
We are given a social identity. We know ourselves as beings in the world because there is a certain kind of environment that molds us. We are socialized into it. See? So it is, if we shape ourselves at all, it is in most men less by the conscious pressure of free soul or intelligence from within than by a response to our environment and the world nature acting upon us. So this exactly You see, there's a lot, the whole postmodern philosophy is based on this kind of an understanding of human freedom, that it's really a conditioned freedom. It's a freedom where the conditions are given and we work in, to a large extent, only by accepting certain choices within a certain limited palette of conditioning forces. See? So, and not by some powerful soul force that can change the conditions of our existence.
Yeah, you just kind of shrug it off and accept it, right? You, once you question that status quo, then it kind of, in a way, it leads to even more problems. So you kind of wall yourself within that.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, exactly. It is mostly less by the conscience of, from them, a response to our environment here. See, it's really the response to the environment and the world nature acting upon us. So that has already conditioned us. And within those conditions, we only sort of become more effective, as it were. In most cases, we are trying to make the best of our conditioning forces, making virtue of necessity, as they say. See? And under those circumstances, we try to get ahead, sort of have the best, of this limited world. See, so rather than bring some idealism into it, or bring a certain kind of, transformative power into it. See? So this is, it's very interesting that, as I was saying, a lot of modern or postmodern sort of philosophy is based exactly on seeing how conditioned we are. Mm-hmm. And that in a sense, even our acts of freedom, so to say, are often the conscience that is internalized in us by these conditioning forces. Conditioning forces make us develop a sense of good and bad, and internalize this sense so that we discipline ourselves. We don't even need somebody from outside to discipline us. And we take it to be our own will by which we are who we are. But it is really the operation of these conditioning forces that creates the responses that we give to the world.
Sure. So the point that this Gnostic being is acting in the next couple of lines down, he says the Gnostic being will take up the world of life and matter, but even though it's not transformed, it's significantly the life and matter at that point is, even though it's not strictly transformed, it's significantly of a different material than in the than that of a being living completely in the lower nature, right?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I mean, he's talking about internal transformation through this, action of this kind of power. Mm-hmm. And certainly, its nature will change significantly.
Devashish.
Yeah, Vince.
You were talking about creativity, the act of creation, and just a while back, and this says, talking about the Gnostic being, he has the secret of a spiritual creation and is in communion and oneness with the Creator within him. It's like the his life is a creative act. That's
exactly
something about creation, yeah.
It is. It's very true. That is exactly what he's saying.
Yes.
He will mold life itself into his own spiritual image, and this he will be able to do because he has the secret of a spiritual creation and is in communion and oneness with the Creator within him. This is the identity, the sense of this particular kind of heightened, union with the image of things to come, and the ability to identify oneself with one's material which here is, say, life force or material, matter force, so that exactly what is willed comes into existence, that transforms the material itself.
Yeah. I mean, isn't like yoga kind of practicing creativity in different forms until you can manifest it?
Yeah, totally. I think certainly that's one way of understanding. I think it's a much truer way of understanding yoga than, you know, looking at it as meditation or as physical exercises or things like that. One of the, you know, really limited reductions that the whole field of yoga has received in modern times, are exactly these kind of forms. Either you talk about yoga, you think, oh, is he talking about meditation? Or is he talking about breathing? Or is he talking about exercises? Well, it's none of those. It's probably better to talk about it in terms of a creative life in more and more heightened forms of union with the creative consciousness.
Yeah, and whatever you find that unlocks the creativity the easiest for yourself. I mean, you can kind of like make a progression of what creative act works best for you.
Yeah. Sure. See, this is one of the reasons why in Japan, Zen had such a tremendous power in secularizing a spiritual life. They basically did exactly what you said, except they stopped short at a certain point. The idea of the transformation of the being, of the subject, was not there, or the instrument. But certainly that idea of uniting with the high power of creativity in whatever it is that you did, just like you said, whether it was war or painting or making gardens or doing flower arrangements or making swords, it was the same ideal of that heightened connection with the sense of harmony and order that was higher than the individual that made it such a spiritual society in that sense.
Yeah, I think that's true of Buddhism. I mean, I find some of their techniques wonderful. It's the theory that I don't, you know.
Yeah. So it's about 9:30 now. Shall we stop for this week and continue next Thursday?
Yeah. Yes. Fine.
Let's end with a brief meditation.